I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. And today, our goal is to learn about our country through the eyes of a traveler from another country. And this is not just any traveler. I've got with me Bernard-Henri Lévy. He's a philosopher from France. He's written 30 books. He's one of the great thinkers in France today. A lot of Americans haven't heard of him, but his name is a household word in France. Monsieur Lévy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting me, my dear Rick. Thank you.
And it's such it's an honor to have a chance to sit down with you and talk about your take on our country, because you have made a study of our country. To get people up to speed, Monsieur Lévy has written a book called American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. And Monsieur Lévy has spent 9 months traveling in our country in the year 2004, looking at our country from a French point of view. I have learned in so many cases we can learn more about our country by actually leaving it. And in the same sense, we can learn more about our country by talking from somebody who takes a foreign perspective on our country. American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. Tocqueville was a great philosopher from France who traveled in America in the 1830s.
Yes, 1831, during 1 year. He was commissioned by the French government in order to study the system of prisons in America, the penitentiary system. And he traveled much beyond that, all over the country of this time, which was not, of course, the same America. America in 1831 was 17 states instead of 50. It was very different, but... this is the extraordinary miracle with the great thinkers. The observations of Tocqueville are still valid, more or less, today, 170 years after.
Wow. And he came here to study prisons. The French government apparently wanted to learn what we were doing in our criminal system.
Exactly. And to try to take lessons, to copy part of it, and so on. He went, much beyond prisons, much above prisons. He tried to investigate on democracy in America, which is the title of his famous book about the democracy in America. And democracy for him did mean not only the institutions, not only the political, the electoral system, but also the way of life, the habits, the customs, the mores, all the things which you are interested yourself, Rick, and which your listeners listen every week when they hear you. Really, the regime of a country being identified and being linked with its way of life. This is what the ancient Greeks said, that the way of life of a country tells about his political way of being more, even more than the institutions. The way of having your cup of tea, the way of having relationship to space, the way of having relationship with race cars in America, the way of having relationship with landscape is much more important than the electoral system in order, if you want, to understand the democracy.
So de Tocqueville was coming to America and he saw America in the 1830s as a pioneer of democracy?
As the most, the best achieved sort of democracy in his time, yes.
At that time, we were the leaders, sort of the experimenters in democracy.
Absolutely. Yeah. But in a way, you are still today. Of course, you are in a crisis. My belief is that you have not the best administration you ever had. It's the least I can say. But the real democracy, the democracy inside, the democracy in the hearts of the citizens, the democracy in the grassroots society is still not only alive, but still vibrant. There is still a vibrancy of it and still exemplary in a way. For me, Frenchman coming from outside, it is so evident.
And you made a 9-month study in 2004 about this in writing your book. And again, I'm speaking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. He is a philosopher from France who's written 30 books. I've got French friends who they know everything about this man. But of course, he's on the other side of the Atlantic now, and we're still learning about him. But his book is American Vertigo. Now, vertigo, to me, that means getting dizzy from spinning around.
Yeah.
So how does, tell me why you called the book American Vertigo.
Because of two different vertigos, my vertigo and your vertigo. Me as a Frenchman, you as American citizens. We both have a sort of vertigo in front of the America of today. Me, it is, I love this country. I'm really fond of it. I'm a friend of America. I am an anti-American, as my friend Adam Gopnik said once, but I am also more than that, pro-American, friend of it. But nevertheless, There were some moments during this journey when I had a vertigo of fear, vertigo of anxiety, vertigo in front of the mega churches in the eastern north, the big evangelical mega churches, vertigo in front of facing, for example, a gun fair which I attended in Fort Worth, Texas.
Wow.
Vertigo in the prisons which I visited, like Tocqueville, since Rikers Island in New York till Guantanamo in Cuba, USA, I don't know exactly.
You went to the prison in Guantanamo?
Yeah, of course. I made a stay there in Guantanamo because I wanted to see with my own eyes. You know, I'm a philosopher, you said at the beginning, but I'm a philosopher who likes to look with his own private eyes. I don't listen. I wait in before believing to see. You know, I'm not confident in the lessons of the others, in the cliches, in the witty, heard by others. So I want to be there. Guantanamo, I knew that there was a real problem there. I knew, I guessed that it was unworthy of the great democracy which America is, but I wanted to see it with my own eyes, which I did. So I spent a few days
there. And this affirmed your suspicion?
Absolutely. It affirmed completely. And it I was totally shocked by what I saw, even if it is not gulag, you know.
What did you see that shocked you?
The treatment of the bodies and the treatment of the souls and the stupidity of the system.
Yeah.
Treatment of the body, I mean, a sort of permanent, even if it is not fierce, but constant humiliation.
Right.
The very fact, for example, that the cells are not separated by walls, that they are completely open one to each other. You can easily imagine some circumstances of life, natural needs and so on, everybody in front of the others.
We have protections in our laws against cruel and inhumane punishment.
This is
right?
What I call treatment of the bodies, right. Treatment of the souls also, right. The very regime of the jail, the fact that the people who are there have no legal status of any sort.
Right.
There are no prisoners of war. There are no delinquents of civil.
Well, the whole rationale is they are outside of the legal system, so they can
outside,
be treated
so
anyway.
This is a terrible.
I'm fascinated by you saying you can learn about democracy more than from reading the textbooks about the government system, but by looking at intimate slices of Americana. You must have looked at sports. We have kind of a religion of baseball. You have a religion of soccer, or what you call football, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you think about American baseball at all?
I did. And I thought, and I visited Cooperstone, which is supposed,
great,
as you know, to be... yes, but wait
the
a
Museum
minute.
Of Baseball, yeah.
Museum of Baseball, Hall of Fame, and supposed to be the place of birth of baseball and the beginning point, which is not true. Cooperstone, this is the very strange history of a place which celebrates an event which never took place. Baseball did not take place, was not invented in Cooperstone. It is not true. And not at the moment which is celebrated, when Abner Doubleday, the famous soldier, general.
Abner Doubleday.
Doubleday.
It's interesting to hear these baseballs with a French accent, yes.
When he was supposed to have invented this and to have fixed the rules in front of a young man of Cooperstone, Doubleday was not there, and the young man of Cooperstone was not born. So there is a very strange story there, which I depict and which I try to disintricate, which is a sort of a myth d'origine, an original myth, a sort of a legendary tale. Like in all the mythologies, like in Greek mythologies, you have some great tales which are supposed to found your belief. Same for the baseball. It is a myth.
Well, you know, countries do need myths, don't they? England
Absolutely.
Needed King Arthur. Germany had its myths when they were joining the family of nations so late in the 1860s, I think. Mm-hmm. They had to create their mythological roots. America has its Paul Bunyans.
America has it, yes. Baseball is part of this creation of creating of mythology. And I must say that they prefer a myth of origin, not very dangerous like baseball. It does not harm, it does not hurt anybody. Rather than some myth of origin of European countries who can be very damaging to the peoples. If you speak about Germany, for example, you understand what I mean.
Well, is there a myth like this for the French culture?
Also.
What is an example?
We have the myth of being an old, genuine, pure, perfect, without any foreign element, nation, which is not true, and which has the effect, this idea of believing that we are an old...
Going back to the Gauls?
Gaulois, Vercingetorix, and
Asterix.
So on. Asterix.
He said Americans don't know Asterix, but that's your...
A little Gaulois chief being rooted in French.
He's your Mickey Mouse, I think.
Our Mickey Mouse, yes, yeah. And fighting against the Romans.
So it's David and Goliath, the French against the Roman Goliath.
But
Asterix.
This idea of Gaulois can have, Asterix is okay, but it can have, if we were politically correct, if we had in France the same politically correctness that you have in America, and which is a good thing, by the way, we would know that all these Gaulois topics and legends, myth, has the effect of excluding a lot of people, of excluding out of the nation our minorities, all sort of minorities, black, Arabs, and Jews also. It has a myth of origin can have as a main effect of putting aside, kicking out all those who came after. So we have to have the most expressed distrust in front of the myth of origin.
Some of these myths then don't fit a melting pot culture when you have many immigrant laborers and
exactly,
so on.
Exactly.
I'm talking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. He's a philosopher from France. I tell you, his name is a household word in France, and we're learning about him now in the United States. After a nine-month trip around America, he's written a book called American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of de Tocqueville, and I think it's an opportunity for Americans to learn more about our country by just putting yourselves in the mind of a Frenchman. Now, I want to talk more about these striking American, what I call backdoors, cultural eurekas. We have this thing in America which is mega. We have mega churches, mega malls, big people. I mean, we celebrate bigness. Yeah. My coffee is much bigger than any coffee you can buy in France, I think.
And you see a burger king size, pizza king double. My opinion, I have nothing against the malls, but I like also the old American genuine little commerces where you have sometimes truer relationship between people.
We call this like mom and pop places.
Exactly.
Now, in France, I've heard there's a gravity to the big cities, and people, even in France, are going to the big cities. Small villages are becoming, not extinct, but they're becoming weak economically, and there's actually an SOS system in France, where you subsidize somebody who will stay in this town and run the store. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. This is one of the advantages of having a strong state. It has some disadvantages also. It deprives the single citizens and the simple individuals of their own responsibilities. In America, when you have a problem, American citizens take it in their hands and they improve and they do their task. In France, we have a tendency to put the arms down and to say, okay, let's wait, the state will solve the problem. But in some emergency cases, as a dying city, a village at the verge of being destroyed and decayed, we are glad to have the state able to fuel some money, to put some subventions and so on, and to save something which belongs to the wealthiness of our country, architectural, memory, and whatsoever wealthiness, cultural wealthiness. You wrote books about France, about Provence yourself, and you know that. You know that some of our villages are as important for our culture as, Honoré de Balzac and Zola and Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, it belongs to us.
Or as the Opera House in Paris or something like that.
Yes, and we have to save it. And in America, unfortunately, sometimes you save your patrimoine, your cities, sometimes not. Sometimes you do. You have some philanthropies, you have some associations of solidarity who take the task in their hand, but sometimes not.
And but politically, this is called the 1,000 points of light. They want individuals to do that instead of the government.
I know.
Two different ways. Now, you're a taxpayer in France. You're happy to pay the taxes for this purpose.
I do, yeah. I'm glad of it.
Generally, French people understand this is a good use
not
of
not generally. It depends. Some no. French people try not to pay so often, but some do. And myself, I think it is okay to pay for that. You know, for example, I give you just one example, not a village, a city like Detroit in America, Detroit, Buffalo also, but Detroit, which is an incredibly beautiful city, belonging really to the memory of this city, with the most beautiful skyscrapers in America. It is just in turning into ruins. A part of the city is ruined today, and ruined without any intervention of whosoever.
This is what I notice when I'm in any big city in Paris. After the stores close, it's a festival of life. People are together in the streets, in the city, right downtown. In so many cities in America, after work, everybody goes to the suburbs and the city is a ghost town.
Exactly.
Did you notice this in your travels?
Course,
is that striking for a French person here?
It is more than striking.
It's tragic
It is a tragedy. I have so many experiences of wandering around at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock p.m. in a big city and finding no place to have a glass of wine or to have a little dinner. Dead city, ghost city.
Yeah.
And this, but not always. You have also some cities, of course, in America, some cities where the people really love their city,
But that takes governmental leadership, I think, to encourage people to stay vibrant downtown.
It should. But sometimes look at Savannah. I had a great love for Savannah in the south, and Savannah is vibrant. Savannah is living, thanks to the citizens and thanks also to the state.
I'm talking with Bernard-Henri Lévy, and Monsieur Lévy has written a book called American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. And this is the result of a 9-month trip that Monsieur Lévy took around the United States in 2004, and it's been written in English and in French. Is it the same exact book, just translated, or did you have to tailor it for French and tailor it for American?
No, it is absolutely the same book. It was written in French, translated by my friend Charlotte Mandel, and it is exactly the same. Will be published in a few weeks in France, but in America first. I would say, why did I publish in America first? I don't know. Maybe because I was welcomed so warmly by the people of this country. Not by the big stars and the big names, but by average people of Washington, of Idaho, of Wisconsin, of East Coast, West Coast. That, for me, it was a way to give back something. It was a way to pay homage to those great people who welcomed me this way. I was told, you know, there is another myth in France, that America could be a francophobic country. That was this myth. Right. And at the moment when I undertook my travel, my journey, more than ever, it was the peak of our difficult relationship on diplomatic levels. And everybody told me, but you will be received with tomatoes and spoiled eggs all over the country. Frankly, my dear Rick, I did not. I met hundreds of people, hundreds, maybe more.
Yeah.
I swear, I did not meet only a single one, man or woman, looking down at me in a dismissive way because I was French.
And
exactly the contrary. Oh, you are French. That's great. Yeah. Exactly the contrary.
Did you disguise your accent or did you speak as French as you sound now?
How could I disguise my accent? I make an effort now. It was even worse when
you
arrived.
I got to say, you look as French as can be and you sound as French as can be.
Course.
And walking down the streets of some Midwest town, and you really,
you can imagine me in Spokane or in South Dakota with my accent, my way of
now,
being. Of course, they identified at the very moment the Frenchie. But it was great.
You
they
can't
welcomed
hide that.
Me.
Conversely, I took 1,000 people to France this last year on my different tours that I lead. And I'm concerned because they spend their hard-earned money on their vacation. I want to know how they're received by the local people, regardless of the differences between our countries politically. I asked them after their trip, were you received warmly? Was there any problem? Nobody reported any coldness or rudeness from the French people.
Of course.
I was taking a tour of a little family winery in southern France, and you know how these wonderful mom-and-pop wineries take visitors around? There was 10 people on the tour, maybe 4 Americans and 6 people from around Europe. The language of the tour was English. And she said, before we start, we've got some Americans here. I want to just say publicly that we still are thankful for America for freeing us from the tyranny of Nazism and Hitler and so on. A lot of Americans are upset because they think if France disagrees with us, we're not thankful for D-Day. I mean, that's absurd, I think.
My dear, as for myself, I belong to a family. My father was a freedom fighter against the Nazis during the war, and before that, a freedom fighter in the International Brigade in Spain during the Civil War. Since I was in the age of understanding it, he taught me that if I was alive, if I had been born, it was because and thanks to America. Wow. My father was a Jew. If America had not liberated France, even freedom fighter as he was, he would have been finished to be caught, to be captured and to be killed. I would not be born. I was born in 1948 after the war because of the American army. So since my childhood, I paid homage and I was grateful to the American army. For me, the GI. I know that today you have some people who identify GI with the worst of the world and so on. You know, GI in Iraq. For me, the image of the GI is forever, till the day of my death, identified to the liberty and to the resistance to tyranny. It will be like this all my life. On the reverse, I can tell you that I met so many people in America who know, who remember, even if it is further, they remember of the time where they were slave people belonging to an empire. There was a colony, America was a colony in the hands of an empire, which was the English Empire. And they remember, they know, because they learned at school that their ally at this time, the ally who helped them to decolonize themselves, was whom? The French.
Yes, you were the first to recognize, I think,
as a country. Of course, the French recognized, the first to be at your side. American people know that. They listened, they learned that at school. Even the most simple people know that. They know that we have some links together, which is absolutely impossible to break.
Good. Now, when you were born in 1948, I know many Europeans named Johnny or Frankie, as old as you, the same age.
Exactly.
And
they
were named after GIs.
After GIs.
Do you know this in France also?
Oh, of course I know. I remember my mother who passed by, but my mother was a charming lady, young until the end, young until her 70s. When she told me about the GIs in 45, 46, before my birth, she told me with so much emotion and so much gratitude, they were really the embodiment, the very face of the liberty. For our generations,
it's a beautiful thing.
My fathers and myself, America is the very face of liberty, of resistance to tyranny. That is why I am so angry when I hear some more young people in France doing some stupid identification and saying that because of the maybe mistake of a current administration who say that America is an imperialist country or even a fascist country, this is disgusting. You cannot say that. It is an insult.
That's why you call yourself anti-American.
Of course. Okay. And that is why I wrote my book. Right. American Vertigo is a book written in reaction to this disgusting way of thinking.
C'est bon. Monsieur Levy, I don't think you need the money from this book, and I got a feeling you're working very hard to promote this book. Why are you working so hard at this?
Number one, I would do that for any of my books. When I published before this one, my book about Daniel Pearl, who killed Daniel Pearl, which was already a sort of book about America. You know, it was a book about an American, at least, and an American hero, and an American hero who fell victim of anti-Americanism, precisely. Anti-Americanism of a Pakistani jihadist group, you know, all that. When I wrote this book, I promoted the same way. I wanted it to go. I wanted it to be read. This is my way of being. I'm a writer. It is my life. It is not my way of living.
Okay.
It happens that I may live by other means, but it is the core of my being. And this book is so important for me because I undertook it. I began it, as I told you, at the peak of the bad relationship between France and America. And it seemed to me so stupid. When I saw our leaders quarreling, I had the feeling of children fighting in a sandbox, you know, in a sandbox, like little
child. I don't like that analogy, but it's true. It's true, I think, yes.
Of course it is true. So I wanted to write this book against it, to help building a little bridge, as you do with your own books about France, you know, you, Rick, and me, yeah. BH, it is a bridge between you and me. There is a bridge. Francophily and Americanophily.
Good.
We can shake hands.
Let's shake hands.
We do, yeah.
All right. Hey, BH, I like that. Bernard-Henri Lévy. You spent 9 months in the States, and you had many people that you connected. To me, people is the essence of good travel, and you couldn't write a good book without meeting people. Of course, you met big shots, Woody Allen and John Kerry, and you met a lot of normal people.
Absolutely.
What people contributed most to your book? What did you find most valuable in researching your book?
Average people. Of course, you have the one you just quoted, and writers also like Norman Mailer or Jim Harrison, another bridge, Jim Harrison, uh-huh. Great writer, American writer, bridging to France. But those big shots were not the most important. For me, this lady, this waitress of a bar in Grand Junction, telling me about her way of living and about the healthcare system in America, how she manage when she is ill without a federal guarantee, as you know, for health and so on. It was so moving. It was so instructive. She taught me so much about dignity, courage, and being an American. She was a great character. Another woman in Los Angeles, North Hollywood, a young woman, a young mother, a young American mother whose son had just been killed in Iraq, a young soldier. Again, great character. This is in the book. I don't want to tell too much because it brings my emotion back. But great lady also telling me so much about American patriotism and the good patriotism, because you have a bad and you have a good patriotism. She told me so much about the good one.
There's something confusing to me. Americans always pride themselves in being friendly and informal, casual, first name basis. But to the French people, this might seem a little bit almost rude or undignified. And you were impressed by the friendliness in America. Did you find the friendliness sincere or just like a smiley face somebody puts on their car?
It depends. Sometimes exactly what you said. Yes, there is a sort of affectation of smiles who did not mean anything, smile just for smile. Who for a
Have
Frenchman,
a
for a Frenchman, yeah, yeah. Have a good day. Are you still working on it? How are you today? And the man who asked you, how are you today? He did not care at all about how I am today.
Because the American goes to France, they might not find this, and they might conclude that these people are not friendly.
Yes, absolutely. No, it does not mean anything. We don't ask every 2 minutes, how are you today? But sometimes we care. We care as much or even more. But you know, at the beginning, I was shocked by that, by this way of smiling for the smile. And then I reflected about it, and my second thought was that it is maybe a real gesture of civilization. You know, this country, at the end of the day, America, has been such a violent country with a strong, deep violence in the 19th century, you know, at the time of the cowboys and so on. You were one of the most violent countries in the world. You had to master the beast. You had to master the beast. And the way of mastering the beast, the violence, the cruelty of the mores, was to have a sort of all these rites of politeness, civility, even sometimes false, even forged, but maybe necessary.
Leave your gun at the door.
Leave your gun at the door.
Yes.
Exactly. Which I saw also. There was a gun fair in Fort Worth, Texas.
Yeah.
A gun fair, which was not the best moment of my journey, to be frank, because I am in favor of gun control. In favor of gun control and gun fair, where you can find any sort of guns, and where you can find some people addicted to all sort of guns. I saw, for example, a stand of Nazis weapons. I did not like that. But the funny point is that at the entrance of this gun fair, you had the billboard, leave your gun at the door.
Oh, is that right?
No weapon admitted.
No weapon.
No weapon admitted.
You know, earlier you said to be frank.
Yeah.
Does that come from the root of the Franks, where French comes from, to be frank?
I don't know, maybe.
That's
maybe,
interesting.
Maybe.
Do you have a similar phrase in French?
Yes, yes. Être franc. Yes, yes. To be
Same
frank.
Thing. To be frank.
To be frank. Yes, I believe that.
I bet it comes from the root of the Frank tribe, from where France came.
This is a form of our chauvinism.
So French are by nature frank.
Exactly. And to be frank means being French. you know?
To be honest.
To be honest. French are honest, and to be honest is to be in French.
To be frank.
If you are honest, you American, you are a little French. That is what chauvinist Frenchness believes. It is stupid, of course.
I think it's interesting.
But, no, interesting, yeah. but crazy. But it is a craziness which is engraved, embedded in our language, mm-hmm. as always.
You can learn a lot from the language
of
that
course.
Way. I'm talking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. I'm working
right.
on my French pronunciation. Bernard-Henri Lévy. No, Bernard-Henri Lévy. And he's a philosopher. He's written a book called American Vertigo. He's written 30 books, but this book really has a poignancy today because it's a Frenchman's take on our country, on America. Monsieur Lévy, when you were in America, you must have seen a lot of national pride. I look at bumper stickers that say, proud to be an American. I see people wearing flags on their T-shirts. And I don't think that's good or bad, but I think that it wouldn't be seen so much in Europe. What is your take on that?
Absolutely. You never see that in Europe. My first impression, by the way, of America when I arrived, my first stage in Newport, it was that flags everywhere, flags at every corner of every street, flags at every balcony, flags in the on the cars.
What does that say to you?
So, number one, it surprised me because we never see flags in France. You can go spend 1 week in France, you will not see one flag, number one. Number two, it said to me, what a strange pride, what a strange arrogance, what a bragging people asserting its patriotism. And then, again, on second thoughts, I believe that it was more complicated, that it might be, you know, like in life, when you see a man who is over-bragging in the relationship to women, for example, a man who says that, okay, no women can resist me. People who brag too much, sometimes they are not so sure of themselves. You are insecure, not so sure. Same on politics. Maybe this over-stressing way of asserting the patriotism does not mean an arrogant pride, but the contrary. Might mean a fragility, a sort of doubt, a sort of questioning on oneself of the American people on their own being a nation.
But now, when you think about the politicians also, American politicians wear a flag on their lapel.
Yes, yes. But when you really need...
In France, would a politician wear a flag
never,
on his
never.
Lapel?
No, in France, you know...
I mean, obviously Germans don't because their flags shy now because of their experience
of course,
with Nazism.
But in France, we are such... We are a very old nation. We are a nation since centuries and centuries, number one. Number two, this nation in France is based on the most solid and consistent thing, which is an earth, a soil, which is roots, which is a long memory and so on. So we did not need to overstress. America, it's more recent. It's the nation of America, this is the greatness of it, is built out of people coming from all origins, Europe and Africa, in Europe, every country is people speaking not even the same language.
So
when
we needed the flag.
You need the flag. You need always to recall to yourself and to build and to solidify the national feeling. So it does not mean that you feel as a strong nation. It means that you feel as a part of yourself weak in being a nation, and you have to reassert it to make it stronger.
But, Monsieur Lévy, you have the most violent national anthem from a lyrical point of view of any nation I know.
I hate it.
Tell me the words in English a little bit. How bloody is the French Marseillaise?
Let's go
cut their throats.
The fatherhood, yes. L'enfant de la patrie. I don't even want to.
Well, I'll tell you what it is if you're not going to.
Blood.
We're going to cut their throats of our enemy.
Impurity of
and
the blood
will
of
be
the
running
enemies,
in the streets.
Running in the street. I hate that. Number one, the blood. Number two, the difference between the pure and the impure blood. It is pure racism. Pure racism.
Yeah.
And the fact that it has been invented during French Revolution does not change anything to the story. It is a racist song.
A racist song. No excuse for it. It's an embarrassment to a lot of French people today. But I guess there's discussion of changing that. I want to just, you've been in America for so much. You know our country far better than I do, I think, with your travels. I would like you to pretend you have a friend in France who's never been to the United States, and you want them to have a meaningful experience because they're confused about America. Maybe they're anti-American and that you'd rather they would be anti-anti-American. What would you recommend they do for we have short vacations here, roughly a 2-week trip. What would you be the essential things they look at in America in their time to gain the best understanding?
A Frenchman?
Yeah, coming to America.
To take a car and to make a coast-to-coast journey. I would say that. Not stay in New York City, even less in Washington, D.C. Take a car, cross the country, take your time, have the physical sense of the ground, the physical sense of the space, meet real people, get bored, get enthusiastic, and on the other side, 10 days of a coast-to-coast journey.
Just road trip.
Road trip.
Right.
I would advise that.
I want to be rather quick on this, but I'd like your take in a nutshell on these places that you visited. Las Vegas.
I did not like Las Vegas. Frankly, I did not like it. It was a sort of temple of kitsch.
Temple of kitsch. Is there a French equivalent?
No, frankly not.
England has a Blackpool.
Yeah.
We have.
I did not like it. I had this discussion with my friend Francis Fukuyama, who told me that if one likes the American people, he cannot dislike Las Vegas because it is the same. I disagree with that.
Okay. Midwest.
Midwest. What was my impression of Midwest? Great landscapes, great people, great courage of the way of being in front of the nature. Also, a very strange thing in the Midwest, very different from France. In France or in Europe in general, in facing the hugeness and the violence of nature, we try to master it. We try to control the nature. Mm. In America, you have not this idea of controlling the nature. You respect it much than you control, and you just push it a little further. Maybe because there is a lot of space, maybe, but maybe because you have a more superstitious, magical, loving relationship to your nature, you don't suppress it, you don't erase, you don't, you push.
Do you consider your book a travel book?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a travelogue, at least.
I've been thinking that the purpose of the medieval jester in the Middle Ages was they had a place in society, the jester. He could come into the king's court and tell him what it's like out there, and he was not killed.
Yeah.
In this post 9/11 environment, do you see any value related to that to a travel book?
At least it is a way to know America, to know the reality of America. There are so many clichés, so many myths, so many preconceived ideas. The first aim of this book, even for the Americans readers themselves, because we French don't know our country, you Americans don't know your country. You know, I'm sure there are things in my book which they will be surprised by. One example, we spoke about the French song La Marseillaise. Do you know about Rushmore? I have a chapter about Rushmore in my book where I say three things, which I'm sure a lot of listeners do not know. Number one, Rushmore, I wondered why it was built there, in this place. There are so many places in America to build Rushmore. And it has been built in a sacred place for the Indians, for the Native Americans. It is one of the most sacred place in the heart of the Indians. Why did the white American want to build it precisely at this point? Number two, the man who built Rushmore, the architect, I discovered that he was a former member of the Ku Klux Klan. And not only former, but having remained faithful to his ancient creed till the end of his life. And number three, the name Rushmore. Why is this place named Mount Rushmore? Why? I thought, as many of the people who, the listeners of today, I thought that it was named Rushmore just because it was named Rushmore from a very long time. No. Rushmore was the name of a man. This man was a lawyer. This lawyer worked at the, very recently, end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, for big gold companies. And the job of this Mr. Rushmore was to expropriate Indians, to steal soils, earth, grounds to the former owners, the Indians, and to give them to the company. So this idea of a memorial of American democracy being built in the sacred earth of the Indians, being named by the stoler, a robber of Indian properties, and being architectured by a former member of the Ku Klux Klan, it is like our Marseillaise. Mm. Big misunderstanding in our sort of mythological birthplace.
In all my life, the thought of Mount Rushmore has made my patriotic heart thump loudly. And with the French perspective, we learn things maybe we did not want to learn.
Exactly.
This is the value of
I'm sorry of that.
No, I think it's a beautiful thing. We're interested in the truth. We're not interested in some mythological con game.
Exactly.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. And we're talking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. He's a French journalist, a French philosopher, author of 30 books, and his latest book is American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. Monsieur Lévy, you traveled all over the United States, and we have, in the United States, we have an interesting split. We've got East and West, we've got Midwest, we've got North and South, we've got Red and Blue. When you traveled around, did you notice that, or is that something that a French traveler would be less likely to see?
Of course, I saw that. You see it at every step. But what strikes me also, what impressed me, is that in spite of that, you are all Americans. You are all Americans. There is a strength of the patriotism, but the good one, the patriotism of the creed, the patriotism of the values, of sharing the same values, the belief in democracy, which does not rely on the origin, on the political belonging, and so on and so on. So, of course, you have the difference, you say, but you have, at the end of the day, the common belonging to the American creed. And this is incredible. For a European country where division is a sort of a real parting of the... you are enemies. When you are divided in France, you are enemies.
Huh.
In America, no. You are opposed.
Yeah.
At the end, you are brothers in America.
So from your perspective, it's clear we have more in common than that, more than that which divides us.
You have
us.
In common America, which is... not a soil, not a root, not a race, but a creed.
A creed.
And a nation which has in common not a soil, not a root, not a race, but a creed is a great nation. It is the best. It is a way when Jean-Jacques Rousseau, one of the founders of the modern democracy, defined his social contract.
Right.
When he tried to define the best democracy in the world, he did not know yet, but he was exactly defining American democracy. Remember Jean-Jacques Rousseau? Of course. Jean-Jacques Rousseau says, good democracy is not democracy of people who come from the same past or who were born on the same space or the same village. Good democracy is democracy which gathers people coming from different places, but making an act of will. An act of will. The act of will is we are different, but we decide by a sovereign act of will to make a nation.
Now, is that the social contract?
Social contract. The social contract, according to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, is that.
Locke had a social contract also?
Also. But Rousseau is the more radical. You can be white, you can be black, you can be left, you can be rightist. You gather, you make a group, and the group makes a common act of will saying, in spite of all that separates us, we build an iron link, which is the act of will of making the social contract. You recognize it's exactly America. And it is the way in which America was built, and it is the way in which America, at each generation, reasserts her own patriotism.
Well, you say celebrate the differences. Vive la différence in France.
Yes, but in America, you celebrate also the differences, but you have a good chemistry, a good dialectic, a good relationship between the difference and the unity. This is your trick. This is your magical touch, your magic touch. It is that you accept the differences, but all the differences come to enrich, to make richer the unity and the patriotism. And this is a great thing.
That's the magic even today of America. Then.
Yes, it is a great...
That can inspire other nations.
It is a great achievement, yes. And I think it could, on this point, we have maybe in France some lessons to draw from your experience. You have lessons to draw from ours.
Sure, yeah.
And we have lessons to draw from yours.
So one book that you're writing can teach Americans how we can learn from France and French how they can learn from America?
It is one of the goals of my American Vertigo. Take an example, Rick. One very single and very burning, if I dare say, example. The riots which were in Paris recently. You learned about that, of course. You had also some riots 10 years ago in Los Angeles. Violent riots. When you compare the two, which I do in my book, in American Vertigo, I compare the two scenarios of the two riots in America and in France. It is clear there is one point where we French are better. and you should take lesson. There is one point about which you Americans are better, and we should draw lessons. The point where you are when we are better French is the police. The way in which the riots were dealt in last November, without one dead, without blood, any blood, was a good thing.
Wow,
believe
that's impressive.
Me.
I hadn't
if you compare
of that.
To the 90s in Los Angeles, where you had so so many dead, good point for France. 1-0. Mm-hmm. Now you reverse. If you look at the pattern of citizenship, which is at work in America and at work in France, the pattern of citizenship, the way of being a citizen, it works better in America. In America, the way, the chemistry between being a Muslim, for example, or being, let's say a Muslim, which is our problem in France, it works pretty well in America. I saw some entire towns in America, like Dearborn, Michigan, which are towns where the majority of the citizens are Arabs, and they feel great Americans, Super Bowl, baseball, and so on. They really feel as American as you. In France, the pattern of citizenship is completely broken, and we have some Arabs in Saint-Denis, in Clichy, who do not feel French at all, who insult our flag, who insult it, which is impossible.
But in America, then the ideal is to assimilate into our culture. It doesn't always work that way, but we celebrate assimilation.
Absolutely.
So you saw the Arab communities in America more willing to assimilate than those in France.
Not only willing, assimilated.
Enthusiastic.
Your mix of salad bowl and melting pot in America works. Our Republican model, which says in a few words, who tells to an Arab, for example, or to a Jew, or to a Hispanic, you forget immediately what you were in order to become what you are going to be, this way does not work.
I've been talking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. You've been a fan of America for a long time, and you report that after a 9-month journey through our country and all of this thinking and meeting all of these people and dealing with all of these difficult issues, your love of America has become even stronger.
Maybe, yes, I think so. You know, Rick, it is like exactly like as in real life. In real life, when you like really somebody, the more you know her, the best you like her.
And I find the same thing when I travel. It's taken me 10-15 years traveling more and more in France, and the more I understand France, the more I appreciate
even
your
with the dark
country.
Sides, even with the ridiculous side we have in France, absolutely ridiculous, chauvinistic, Gallic, stupid things. I'm sure you are aware of them, but it does not prevent you from liking France. It is like in life, when you are really fond, in love with your wife, which I am and which I'm sure you are too, when you are really in love with your wife, you know her little sides, you know her weaknesses, you know many little things, but it makes her even more lovable. You love her even more because you know her weaknesses, and she is not only a big statue, a big...
Yes.
Same for the country. Today, I know America pretty better than I did. I know the bad side of the moon also. I know it. I had a whiff of it at least, but it did not prevent me to breathe so well in this country, all over the country, in the South, in the North, in Seattle, in Savannah, in Chicago, in Boston, in the West. I loved it. It is one of the great experiences of my life, to be frankly.
I bet it was an enjoyable study for
more,
you.
More than enjoyable. It was a great moment of the life. It was a great enthusiastic moment of my biography.
I've been talking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. He is the author of American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. Merci bien, monsieur.
Merci, Eric. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.